There's a lot of talk these days about new math and questioning why educators want to change how math is taught. Parents, colleagues, and even the general public often push back wondering why we can't just teach math the way they learned it. That's why I was so excited to sit down with Mike Flynn, a national leader in math education, a former second grade teacher, and the founder of Flynn Education. Mike has spent his career helping teachers navigate change, and in this conversation, we dig deep into understanding and addressing resistance to change in math education. In this episode, we explore why resistance happens, whether it's from parents, colleagues, or even within ourselves, and how we can navigate it productively. We discuss productive versus unproductive beliefs about math, how to create a math community where it's safe to take risks, and why approaching resistance with curiosity instead of judgment makes all the difference. If you've ever struggled with pushback in your teaching, this episode will give you the mindset shifts and strategies to move forward. So let's jump in. Mike Flynn, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad that you are here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yes, it's been so fun to get to see you in person at different conferences, and now we get to bring our conversation to the podcast, which I know so many of our teachers are going to be really excited about. So I thought we would just jump right in, and I wanted to ask you about resistance in math education. And I feel like we can't really talk about why there's resistance to a lot of the things we're doing in math education without really understanding why we get resistance in the first place. So do you have any thoughts on that?
I have a lot of thoughts on that, actually.
Really big question.
Well, you know, it's funny because this whole idea of addressing resistance in math education has been kind of one of my niche areas, but I didn't start out as like, let me become an expert in this and let me dig deep. It actually came from, I had a PD experience. I was working in a school and I was doing an after-school PD with this district I was working with for a while. And I encountered some really obnoxious behavior from a team of teachers, but one person in particular. And it shook me. I had such a bad session because I was all in my head about it. And then I thought, you know what? I need to figure this out. And because my first thought was like, maybe I'm not cut out for coaching. But I realized when I was a teacher, when I had kids that didn't want to read, I had one kid who would chuck his book on the floor. I couldn't say, well, fine, you just won't read. That's fine. I don't have to worry about you. I had to figure out what is causing this behavior? And I realized I need to figure the same thing out with adults. And the funny thing is that for me, I don't know if this works for you, but sometimes when I want to learn something or learn about something, I'll submit a proposal to speak about it even before I've learned it. And so at the time, NCSM proposals were due. So I wrote a proposal about understanding and addressing resistance to change. And shortly after, when we got the responses, I actually got a call from them, which is not usually just get the email. And they said,
right,
we want to make this a featured session. And we can't wait to hear all the things that you've learned. I thought, me neither, right? I've got to learn it now. So, but I share that just because I think it's helpful for people who do work in change to recognize that you don't need to be an expert and that there's a lot of stuff out there to support your understanding and build your understanding both of where resistance comes from, why it's very pervasive, particularly in math education, and what we can do about it. So the where it comes from, a lot of this, we can categorize it. So there's different kinds of resistance. That's one of the things that really struck me is sometimes when we think about people who resist, I'll often ask people, what are stereotypes or assumptions you can make about people who resist change in general or in math education? And just out of curiosity, what would you say? This isn't your beliefs. What do you think? Generalized stereotypes how would you describe people who resist change, or what do you think comes up when we ask people that question? What phrases?
Probably close-minded. Mm-hmm. I think to some extent, maybe some arrogance, thinking that they know better than, and just aren't willing to be open to other perspectives. I'm sure laziness is one that people usually say because they don't want to do the work to see another perspective.
Yeah. And you could add stuck in their ways, apathetic, you get a pretty exhaustive negative list of traits. But the interesting thing is that of all the categories of resistance, apathy is the one that's least common. That they're actually, when you start to look at why people resist, sometimes people resist because they're exhausted. Like we've all taught, and you've been in schools where it's like, okay, we've got a new initiative on science and ELA, and we have, there's a new SEL program, and we've got a new lunch count system. And there's like, and now there's a new math program. And,
right.
and so you've got new thing after new thing. So some people are just exhausted from it. Some people resist because they don't feel like they have the knowledge of, like, they're not sure, like, what am I, how do I change how I teach math? I don't even know other practices. Some people lack confidence. It's, I don't feel confident in confident math, and to change my practice, I only know this little thing, take me out of that comfort zone, I'm going to push back. Another one that surprised me was resistance because of lack of agency or involvement, that a decision was made and teachers weren't part of the process. That's actually an interesting thing with that one is I actually, when I was still teaching, I was labeled a resistant teacher. And it was for that reason. In math education, I resisted.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, the thing I resisted is we had a new superintendent come into our school and basically after 1 year said, we're getting rid of, we had a really good progressive math program. And she said, we're basically going to get a teacher-proof textbook, because we can't trust teachers to make the right decisions in math. So in some ways, here's one other surprising thing with resistance is, like, it's not always a bad thing. It just depends on what side of the issue you're on, right? So in some of my colleagues looked at my role in that work as like advocacy, and where other people are like, no, that's resistance. And but then in the role I have now where I'm trying to have teachers shift practices to build more student-centered learning, I encounter when people push back, I interpret that as resistance, where they may be interpreting it as advocacy. I'm advocating to keep things the way they are. It's kind of an interesting thing. So it's not such a cut and dry, I guess a phenomenon. It really is pretty gray and murky.
Yeah. Well, and it's also interesting too, because I think we get resistance in a lot of different ways. Like, we can obviously have like students who are resisting to experiencing or learning math in the way that we are trying to, because they're used to maybe one way of, you know, let me teach you first and then you mimic it. And then we can have resistance with other teachers who maybe you are the one who's really trying to push forward teaching in a certain way. And maybe the teachers on your team are resistant. But in my experience, we also have a lot of parents who are resistant to the way that we are teaching math now. And I know that that's a really big challenge when you feel like you don't have the support of parents, or maybe parents don't understand it. And so do you have any ideas, or do you have any experience working with parents who are resistant to the way that we teach math now?
Very much. Yeah. But when it came to the way we were teaching math, we would definitely see a lot of pushback because it looks very different than what they've experienced. And what I've come to learn when I've done my deep dive into understanding resistance beyond just like teachers is that from a caregiver standpoint, there's a couple of things that are in play here. The first is there's a phenomenon known as the apprenticeship of observation. And this actually I learned about as a pre-service professor when I was teaching pre-service teachers. And this was Dan Lordy wrote about this like way back in the 70s, but it's still true today, which is of all the professions, think of every profession there is, which profession have people observed someone doing the most? So think about everyone who's gone through school from preschool all the way through high school and even beyond. If you go preschool through even just a bachelor's degree, think of the number of hours that you've spent watching educators do what they do. And some of us went into that profession, but lots of people haven't, but they feel like they've got such a good understanding of what a teacher does based on their observations of them doing their work. And that's what's called the apprenticeship of observation, because what the result is that teaching, which is a very complex job, looks very easy when it's done well. And much like if we went to, like, so we all go to the dentist, right? I've got a general sense of what a dentist does, but I don't have the confidence where I could jump in and like, and fix someone's tooth or whatever. Right. I know that they have specialized training, but that same belief doesn't always transfer to education because it seems so easy. And because caregivers are raising kids. So it's like, I'm raising kids and I'm teaching them at home, and I've seen teachers do their job and it's not really that hard. So one part here is that because they feel like they understand what we do so much, when we change things because we're improving our practice, there's a pushback because as a caregiver, I might say, well, that worked for me. Like, I'm fine. I'm an accountant, or I'm a rocket scientist, whatever it is. people will say, well, that I grew up in this other way of teaching and that's what worked. And now you're trying to change that. They don't realize that, sure, they got through the system, but how many of their peers didn't? How many people chose a different career path or didn't even make it out of high school because of math and because they didn't understand math and because the way math was taught favored one kind of way of thinking about math, which is speed and calculation,
right,
and didn't embrace these other ways that kids can also demonstrate really high math proficiency, which doesn't look like fast, quick answers. And so that's one part of it is it comes in from that. The other thing that's happening is that we all have instincts to protect ourselves and our families. And that sometimes can be triggered when we feel like there's a threat to our families, right? So if I'm a caregiver, I'm worried about my kids getting a good job, getting into whatever colleges I think they should get into. And if I start to panic that what you're doing as a math teacher is going to prevent my kid from passing the state test or getting into an honors class or whatever my preconceived notion of what their path is going to be, I can start to freak out, which then also triggers the amygdala response, right? So now I'm like panicky. So I'm not making the best choices. I'm pushing back. I might even push back in a not so friendly way because I'm sort of activated. And I also believe that teaching's an easy job. And then the other one, which is there's one last phenomenon known as the Dunning-Kruger effect. And so are you familiar with that at all? This idea, it's funny. So the Dunning-Kruger effect is kind of neat. It's this phenomenon where people who don't have a lot of experience with something have an inflated sense of confidence in their ability to do that. And reference I usually make with this is there used to be a show called Faking It, where they would like take someone from like one field and have them fake being in another field. And the one I love was they took a punk rock singer and musician, and they tried to fake him as a orchestra conductor. And when they're interviewing him, he's like, well, how hard can it be? You just kind of do this with your hands. And so the conductor's like, well, go ahead and try. And he's got this whole orchestra and he tries to do it and it's awful. And he realized, oh, there's something to this that I don't like. There's a lot more to it than I understood. And so with this, it's not for everything, but teaching is one of those professions because of that apprenticeship of observation that people have a sense of confidence like, oh, I could easily do this. But then we know if you ask any of those people like, oh, it's so easy, you put them in front of a class, sub in a classroom, go sub in seventh grade for the day, go sub in fifth grade, go sub in kindergarten for the day. You can imagine that the confidence drops. And that's what happens with the Dunning-Kruger effect is you see this like XY axis. So there's an amazing amount of confidence. And then as they have experience, there's this plummet, almost like this where the confidence tanks because they realize, oh, I don't really know. There's a lot more to this. And then over time, that as they get more experience, confidence starts to come. But then there's this realization that like, I know a lot, but I still have a lot more to learn. But it's that initial high level of confidence, which we see actually in teachers, we see in caregivers and other folks in the math world, because it does feel like on the surface, math's really easy to teach. But then when you get into like really teaching for kids to understand, you realize, ooh, it's actually, there's that little bit of a plummet. So that's where you can also, when that plummet happens, is also where educators start to resist because they're like, oh, my confidence is gone. And I want to go back to that where it felt really comfortable and I was really confident.
Yeah. Okay. So this brought up like two different thoughts for me. I think the first in talking about parents, there's this quote that I love. I have no idea who said it, but I probably say it at least four or five times a week. It is the difference between judgment and compassion is understanding. And so when we can like take time to understand where maybe a caregiver is coming from, it moves us from this place of feeling really judgmental or frustrated with them to like having a degree of compassion of saying like, they are uncomfortable. They want what's best for their child or, you know, the child that they're caring for. And so I think that I appreciate you sharing the whys behind someone being uncomfortable, because I think it allows us to feel or to approach it in a little bit more of a compassionate way.
Yeah, I love that's a great way to kind of look at that that understanding piece and how important that role is.
Yeah, it's a very great mindset to have when working with, I mean, just relationships professionally, but also personally. Like, anytime I have this feeling of like judgment or frustration, I'm like, okay, what is their perspective? Like, where are they coming from? But yeah. You know, the other thought that came up for me as you were talking is, you were talking about the fact that there's so much more to teaching math than what a lot of people think. And I actually just had this experience. I'm, you know, partnering with the university and mentoring a couple of the newer teachers who graduated. And, you know, something was said about one of the teachers, and it was that they should be fine. They're moving to kindergarten, and kindergarten math is easy to teach. And it just reminds me of this fact that, there, have you heard of the domains of math knowledge for teaching, like the oval chart? And like one of those sections is obviously knowing how to like do the math, right? Like we can all do like 2 + 3 = 5. But I think there's so many people, both outside of education and even inside of education, who don't recognize that there's so much more that goes into teaching math. And so I think there's a little bit of resistance, or my hunch or my guess, and I'd be interested to hear your perspective on this. I feel like some of that resistance is because we're only focusing on like, if the teacher can do the math, then like it should be easy to teach, and not recognizing that there's so much more to teaching math. And so they resist these other strategies because it just feels like extra. And it's like, no, this isn't extra. Like, this is part of the job. It's a required part of the job.
Yeah. Well, two things. Well, when you were talking first about that sort of the compassion piece there, it did remind me of that. I don't know if you ever watched Ted Lasso, but there's a great scene where he talks about being curious and not judgmental. And that's just like, it just resonated with me what you were saying, like, oh, that's like total Ted Lasso philosophy around like, what, you know, whether it's a student, caregiver, a colleague or whatever, that's just a good standpoint to have. But to get to this idea of like, of where teachers may push back when we start to look at just the level of complexity, there's a lot of things happening with that. And I think when we go back to the categories is like, if I'm a teacher, I'll go back to when I first started teaching, because this also may surprise you. When I first started teaching, I was a big teller. I thought my job was to just explain to kids how to do things and then have them practice it a bunch of times to see if they've got what I told them to do. And for me, I think at that time, the thought of doing what I saw my mentor colleague doing seemed just like that's going to take a whole weekend of planning. And like, I don't even know enough of the math to really let kids off the reins like that to like go explore, because like, what if they come back with something I don't get? I had all of these feelings that I often encounter when I'm working with teachers, and that you're kind of mentioning, where it feels like there's so much here. And so part of it could be that there is that lack of knowledge, that I don't know enough about fractions besides common denominator. So if I'm going to open up a conversation or allow kids to like have other ways to compare fractions, and I don't get it, I don't feel like I can do that well. And so it's much easier for me just to stay in my lane and make the kids stay in my lane. And so that's one part that you encounter. The other one could be that there's a whole thing around belief systems. And I love what NCTM does in both Principles to Action and in their Taking Action books, where they list productive beliefs and unproductive beliefs about different things. And so one thing when you work in change in math education is that you encounter a lot of beliefs. And an unproductive belief that often comes up is that kids can't do this, or kids can't think this way, or kids will be confused if you show them more than one way to solve a problem, or kids need to be shown how to do it before they can explore. There's all of these would fall under unproductive beliefs. And so you could get resistance because people at their core don't believe the thing that you're asking them to do, because they don't think either kids can do it, or they don't think that they can do it as a teacher. Yeah. So that's the other unproductive belief, is like, I'll sometimes when I'm working with teachers, is I'll try to, when they say kids can't do that, when I'm doing professional learning in schools, we co-plan and I'll teach a lesson to their students, and we'll see kids do the things they said they couldn't do. But then the next sort of defense that comes up is like, well, yeah, you can do it with the kids can do it with you, but they can't do it with me. Like, I am not able to do that. And that's like the next shift in this practice. But I think there's that knowledge piece, which we just have to acknowledge that a way to address that is by helping teachers to build their own content and pedagogical knowledge. Because the other thing that's really fair, when we think take that being curious versus judgmental, having that empathy stance, is that there's an immense amount of guilt when you feel like you don't know all the content you're supposed to teach, right? I was hired as a teacher, I should know these things. But someone once told me that the math we're supposed to teach today is not the math we learned. The math we learned was a little narrow fraction of that. And so the metaphor I use is, imagine that we have this massive book of all the math. It's the great book of math, and every math idea ever, like all the math that was discovered and all the math that's yet to be discovered, is in this book. When we grew up, our teachers skimmed it. We just got the little chapter on fractions, we skimmed a little bit of multiplication, a little bit on functions. So we've got like the gist. And then imagine that those of us who decide to become teachers, well, now we have to teach this book, but we're also told we got to teach more of each of the chapters, but we haven't read them. When you help teachers realize it's not their fault that they don't have the depth of knowledge they need, they were never given that opportunity. None of us were. And sure, we go to college, right? We take a math methods class, but even that, like I took a half a semester. And when I worked at Mount Holyoke, when I taught the methods, it was half math, half science. So really a half semester of math methods. There's not a lot to build out that knowledge. And so that's where professional learning comes in. So that has a huge impact. That's actually what my doctoral study was on, the effect of building teachers' content knowledge and how it affects their perceptions of math and things like, spoiler alert, it greatly increased their confidence, and it increased their belief in like the positivity around math, and that they felt more capable as math teachers as their content knowledge grew. And so that's one way you can help people who are feeling resistant because they don't feel like they have the knowledge. The belief piece gets a little trickier because you need them to see more than once that kids can do this or that they can do this. And so it takes a while to disrupt that belief system, but that's also a pathway to help address some of the resistance. But the thing that sometimes happens is that, let's say in your school, you've got some who are resisting because they don't have the knowledge or the confidence. You have some who are resisting because they don't have the beliefs in it, or they don't value this. And if you don't, you can't do a one size fits all approach to address it, because the people may have the beliefs, but they don't understand how to do it. They need a different kind of support than the people who don't believe kids can do this or that they can do this. And then the other thing is that it's also easy as leaders to just dismiss it and say, oh, they're lazy and stuff, right? Because it's not your whole staff that's resisting, it's pockets. And so there's that easy excuse of like, all right, I don't need to worry about them. And then we'll just let them do what they want to do, which is also the wrong thing, because everybody wants to be a great teacher. And I think we just need to take the time, the same way we do with students, is to figure out, what is their need? What's getting in the way for them? Take that empathy stance, right? And craft customized coaching experiences and professional learning experiences to give people the opportunities to expand their own understanding or their confidence or changing their beliefs in a way where they start to buy into this shift that we're wanting to see them make.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting because there, another quote I heard, don't remember why I heard it, but it said it talked about wherever the blame is being placed, that's where the power is. So if we're like blaming the other person because they're resistant or because they are apathetic or whatever, then we're waiting on them. They have the power, they need to change. And then there's, it absolves us of any part in it. And so I've really tried to take this mindset of, okay, like what can I do? Like what is within my control? What am I contributing to this? There's actually so many ways that we can go with this conversation. Is it like, teachers who are resistant, admins who's resistant, students who are resistant, parents who are resistant, but let's talk teachers for a second. So maybe this is for the teacher leaders who have teachers on their team who are resistant to a certain, to teaching in this way, or you're a coach who's working with teachers and is resistant. But what are the things that the teachers who are in this position, who are, after they are curious and they're seeking to understand why there is that resistance, what are some things that they have within their control to do to kind of like tear down some walls and push past the resistance?
A big part of this, I think we've touched upon it a bit with having this like empathetic, Elena Aguilar calls it the inquiry stance, which is taking the time to very consciously put yourself in the shoes of that person. And that sounds very cliche, but what is known, there's another phrase that it's called intellectual empathy. And I forgot which researcher calls it that. It's the same idea, which is that you intellectualize the viewpoints of this person there's an article that I can share with you that you can link to for people if they want, which it was a 3-part series that Elena Aguilar wrote for Ed Week, I think. And in there are specific questions that you could ask yourself of your colleague, or if you have a good relationship, you can ask your colleague. But one of them could be like, what prior experiences has this person had in mathematics that could be contributing to the way they're behaving or feeling? Another one is, how connected do they feel to their team or to the school or to the change? Right. And if it's like, oh, they're always eating lunch by themselves. They're not part of the group. They're new to the school. No one's really kind of bonded with them yet. And now there's this district initiative or school initiative. Well, they don't feel a part of it. Right. So you start to get some perspective. What else could be going on in their lives that could be happening? They may have a sick parent. They may have, maybe their relationship is breaking up. Maybe their dog's dying. Like, so there's lots of things that affect us as humans that we take with us into our workplace that manifest itself in a way that, like, they have this bold reaction. And you're like, where did that come from? And then we internalize it. Like, is it me? And so by taking this inquiry stance and realizing that there could be a lot of other things at play here, it helps us to understand the resistance we're seeing and not put the blame on ourselves or cast aspersions on the person, because that's the other thing with resistance is if we start labeling teachers as lazy, apathetic, even calling them a resistant teacher, we're already putting a divide in between us. That's something Elena also talks about, this, like, she calls it like a moral and psychological divide, that even if you hold your cards close to your chest, people can perceive it. And so it forces you to really get into their shoes, build that empathy, even if they're rude to you, even if they're, you feel like it doesn't excuse the behavior, but it helps you to understand where it's coming from. And it allows you not to internalize it. And because of that, you can then, you're in this space to respond to what they say or how they're acting or what they're doing versus reacting to it. Because that's the worst thing you need to be. Because here's the thing with resistance, it can trigger pretty nasty behavior. And sometimes it's out of our control. It's a funny thing with our brains and evolution. So we have our amygdala, right? That's our fight or flight and flee, whatever, all the things. And we have, we don't have the same threats to us, like where like some giant animal is going to attack us as we're like walking to school or something. That's gone, but we still have that part of our brain, and it actually gets triggered by things like threat to status, threats to like embarrassment, like just if any perceived threat can trigger that, and that's sometimes math change can have that effect. And so when you get somebody who's triggered and they may say or do things, if you're not in that position to have that intellectual empathy and to be able to step back and not personalize it, when I went home from that first day and it was beating myself up around it, it really can affect you. But that can be really empowering because it puts you in this position to help versus this sort of defensive stance or even just wanting to walk away. So that I think is really important. The other thing that's really helpful, particularly if people are resisting because they have an unproductive belief. There's Jack Mesereau, I did a whole session on it at NCSM last year, but he has this adult learning theory that goes back decades, but it's called transformative learning theory. And it's about what happens when you're changing people's beliefs. And the very first thing that does that is what's called a disorienting dilemma, where you give them an experience that completely upends the way they thought things were going to be. So for example, if teachers feel like manipulatives are a big waste of time, right? That's a common unproductive belief in math. It's a waste of time, right? One of my favorite things to do in a professional learning setting is have teachers work in base five. So we change the whole base system and they're not comfortable yet, right? And I don't give them base five materials or anything first. They have to kind of play. I only do this for a couple of minutes to create that disorientation where they're confused, they're frustrated. And then I bring out base five blocks and they gravitate to them. They start to realize like I can build out all of these problems and it makes sense and I can solve it. And by the end of that 45 minute experience, you'll have people saying, I need to call my principal and get more manipulators in my classroom, right? Yeah. So that is a really helpful tool that people could use with resistance. But one thing to remember is that when your belief is tripped up, when you disrupt someone's belief system, if that belief they have is also really close to their core, like I believe with my soul that kids need to be shown what to do. And then I see my own class responding to a teacher or a coach who's teaching my class and having all these rich conversations that I didn't know they were capable of. And I've never given them a chance to do that. The guilt that comes with that is huge. And so I've had teachers cry in those moments. And there's a very important thing for anyone in this space of change to do is to recognize that is the most vulnerable time for that colleague when they are recognizing they may have had a belief that wasn't true. And two things can happen. If you don't do anything with it, and if that feeling feels so awful to them, they can very easily dismiss what just happened as, oh, well, this was like, we had four teachers in the room for that coaching cycle and this kid was out, and I start to create excuses. And then I build a wall around myself so I can go back to my previous beliefs. And it's going to be a lot harder for me to break down that wall again. I'm going to be less likely to invite you into my classroom, right? The other thing that can happen in that moment is if you as a colleague or a coach or anyone are right there for them to support them from in that moment when they're feeling pretty vulnerable and help pivot them from the emotional side of it to the intellectual side of it. So I'll give an example. When I had this teacher crying because her kids were doing all these things she didn't think they could do, and she said, I just feel so guilty and everything. I said, but first of all, I was the same way. Like, and I didn't say this. I was the same way. That's what I thought too. And let's think about all the reasons why we would think that. Cause I thought that, my mentor thought that at one point, you thought that, I bet most of your colleagues thought that. Why do you think that was? And she says, well, that's how I learned. I'm like, yeah, that's how I learned too. What else? And so you get away from the emotional side, you get into the logical side, and they start to realize there's not anything wrong with them. Like it's right. Like, it's not bad to have an unproductive belief. It's like, it's fine. And when you learn that that's not productive, then move, you have a place to move from there. But the guilt that comes with it, we have this defense mechanism in us because we don't want to feel shame. And so we can dismiss things pretty quickly. So good coaches, good colleagues are right there to support them and help them intellectualize it and get out of that like yucky feeling, because that feeling is awful. But once you get through that and then they understand, okay, I'm not alone, then you can start planning. So then if lecturing the kids is not what we're going to do, then what can we do differently? And that's when you have someone who's ready to make that journey because they want to.
Yeah. And you know, I think that so much of this to me, like, can be like summarized in that it's not always like the just telling someone, oh, this is research, this is best practice. And whether that is a colleague or a parent, and it's funny, my husband and I went to a dinner detective date. It was like a murder mystery. And like, there's like people who are positioned at your table who are like part of it, but you're trying to figure it out. And, you know, so people were asking about careers and I told them what I do in math and they were like, oh, math, that's awful. And why do they teach math this way? But it was an entire table of people who were just truly bashing the way that we teach math now. And, you know, going back to what we're talking about now, it's like, I couldn't just say, well, that's what research says is best now, you know, like it's so much more than just telling. And I think what you are saying is it really is, there's so many aspects of, you know, connecting with the emotional piece to it, like their fear, their guilt. There really is a relational and emotional piece to really overcoming resistance in math with others. Is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big part. And that whole idea of not just telling. So Chip and Dan Heath, who wrote a book, not about math, but it's called Switch: How to Change When Change is Hard. There's a quote, which is, if you want people to change, you can't just hit them in the head. You need to hit them in the heart. So don't, it's not enough to make them think something. You have to make them feel something a lot of times. And so you could say, yeah, research says this, but what if, like, I've done base five with caregivers. When I do like family math nights and things, base five's a part of it, because it's a nice, easy opportunity in a very short amount of time for them to see the power in the use of these tools and why we make the connections from like concrete and to like abstract and kind of blend all these things together. That's a very visceral experience for them, which then once they have that feeling, they're more attentive or more attuned to the intellectual argument we're giving them, because now they're more motivated. Like we've kind of got that, like that disruption. And now we can give some more of the knowledge base where they'll receive it better.
Yeah. And I also think with the base five activity as well, it kind of puts them in a place where their guards are not up, because they aren't expected to know base five. Like if you had done that with something that they were expected to already know, I think you automatically have the heightened reaction of like, I should know this. Am I going to do it wrong? And all of that. But with something that's entirely something that they've never seen before, are not expected to know, they can actually just experience it and be open to it.
Yeah.
And not have all of the mental drama.
Levels the playing field, right? No one's got the edge unless they somehow geek out on different base systems, you know, which I've encountered a couple of times. You do it enough times with caregiver audiences and there's someone who's like, oh yeah, I do binary and I love base 12. And it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. And then I'll just, yeah, that's a whole other thing. And you got to teach them how to like hold it back. Cause then you have another, then you got someone out in the mix telling everyone like, just do this. And it's like, no, you're breaking the whole system.
You know, I think this also goes to, you know, that person can also, when, as soon as like, they're like, well, I know it and this is easy and all of that, it kind of puts a damper on the community at that point. And so the other thing that I was thinking about as you were talking about earlier is the fact that just as much as it's important for us to have a really safe, classroom community around math, it's also really important that we have a really safe, like teacher community around math as well, because I don't think these discussions can happen in this like openness to change or openness to questioning our beliefs and practices and all of that can happen when a teacher is maybe not feeling respected or is already kind of like on their heels feeling like they're having to prove themselves, or like we really do need to put thought and intention into creating a space where the resistance can even be kind of like worked through.
Yeah, that's huge, right? Because the creating that space means it's a space where you can be vulnerable and you could be, there could be things that you don't know yet, right? It's where the learning can happen. The greatest amount of learning can happen in a space where you can take risks and without fear of judgment, where you could, and where people also respect that we're all on different, we're on different parts of the journey within the math. And because of that, if we're very mindful both of how we show up as learners, whether we're kids, because this works with kids as well as adults, if I'm mindful of like, what are my needs as a learner coming into a math problem? If I'm going to join a group of two at a whiteboard as a kid or an adult, what's my go-to move? How do I find my way into the work? And then, which is important, we want to be able to know that. But then the second step is, how do my partners also come into this work and what do they need? And what could I do to help them? What if we had a set of agreements around both the ways in which we take care of ourselves and we take care of the learning of others, but then also getting into that space of like vulnerability about like, when are times that we feel really unsure of ourselves in math, or when's a time when you felt embarrassed in math? Like having conversations with adults or with kids around these topics can completely transform the entire classroom. There's actually research around this where has nothing to do with math. A lot of times what I do is I look outside of the math world and get into psychology and get into like business and marketing, all these kind of things, and see how it all plays into math. And there's this study that was done by Art Aaron called I don't know the actual name of the study. It's been co-opted by the relationship community, called the 36 Questions to Fall in Love. And that comes from the study where they asked participants to, before they got paired with anyone, rate how close they are with like your mom, your dad, your uncle, your neighbor, your roommate, your, you know, whatever, a whole bunch of people in their lives. And then they paired them with a stranger. And all the strangers, they would have to go through three rounds of questions, 12 questions per round. And the first round questions were things like, what constitutes a perfect day for you? Round ones were all like that. Now, round two questions, and I'm not going to make you go all the way here, but round two question, like an example of that, was what is your most treasured memory? Now, you don't have to answer that now, but that's the level. Notice the difference in that. And so there was 12 of those questions. Round three questions, this is actually one from the study. You can tell how deep I've gotten into this. If you were to die this evening with no opportunity to communicate with anyone, what would you most regret not having told someone, and why haven't you told them that yet?
Oh, wow.
Go ahead. We're not just kidding.
I'm not gonna make it. Am I going to cry on the podcast? Yeah.
But I think of the level of how personal that is, right? And that's just one of 12 questions at that level that they also had to answer. Well, here's the thing. At the end of those questions, they had to rate their closeness to their partner in the study. And what do you think happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was probably very, very close, like probably closer than some family members.
Exactly. And so here's the thing, it has nothing to do with the questions. It has to do with two things were happening. There was escalating and reciprocal vulnerability. The reciprocity is huge, because when you are vulnerable, if you shared something really personal and said like, this was a really traumatic event for me, I said, wow, that's tough. And that's it, right? You like that doesn't allow for like any closeness to form, right? But if I acknowledged it and then reciprocated by sharing like an equally or even more escalated vulnerable moment, there's a closeness that happens. Like it just, that's a normal thing that happens with humans outside of education, inside education, doesn't matter. So that's the huge thing. Now, this doesn't mean for teachers or for PD providers, coaches, that you ask your participants or students to say those things. But what you want to do is the same kind of thing, is like make, especially in this beginning of the school year, maybe as the kids go off to work in their class, in their groups for a task, say before you start the math, I want each of you to share a time when you were really excited in math, right? You start light. That's a round one, right? Mm-hmm. And then it takes a minute for everyone just to share, like, and you tell them just for 1 minute before you do the math, or you maybe before you send them all off, have them turn and talk with a partner. And then you then always lead with yourself. You're always vulnerable first. So sharing our favorite time, we're not being vulnerable, but we work toward that. So maybe later we have a conversation around when's a time when you feel unsure of yourself in math? And I'll start by saying, I'll be honest right here. So I do trainings in schools. I work in a lot of schools. I do preschool through high school. I'm least confident. Well, I feel most unsure when I'm teaching high school math, when I'm working with high school teachers, because I have the least amount of experience in that. And I always have imposter syndrome with it. And so that's a real vulnerable moment by me opening up about that, it makes it safer for other people to do that. But what's interesting is like, if you listen to kids talk about that question and they'll say, when there's anything where I have to be timed, or it feels like there's some pressure, or if it's a word problem, I feel unsure of myself, or if it's fractions, and then like that kid shares that, but then seven other kids say, yeah, I feel the same way with fractions. Think about what that does in the classroom.
Right.
If you're that kid that's like, if we don't share those things, you have students individually thinking, I'm the only one who doesn't know, exactly. Who doesn't feel comfortable with fractions. I'm the only one who doesn't like word problems. And you realize there's a community of people who feel just like you. It could be everybody. It could be like in the class where like my perception of you as a student is like, you're the math whiz in here. And when you share something that where you're unsure, I'm like, Brittany's unsure about things in math. Like, how is that possible? But it makes it safer for me to be unsure. It changes the dynamic. It really does. And this works in professional learning. works in classrooms. It doesn't need to be the whole focal point of the year, but if you take the time to do that, then kids, it normalizes a lot of the things that people are uncomfortable with. And because we realize most of us feel that way, but it also provides space for them. Like if I know that you're uncomfortable doing any division work with decimals, like that's a place where you, and we're actually on that unit now, and I'm your partner in work. I am coming to that recognizing that you as a learner might not be in your most confident space right now, and that I can think about ways that I can support you in that space. And you might know that I don't like anything where there's time pressure. So we can kind of, you're not going to rush me. You're going to give me some processing time because I need that. And that's a really powerful thing that we can do to create those spaces.
Yeah. And, you know, and this is something that like we instinctively know because we have people in our lives who do a great job at this. Like I can think of several people that I'm like, oh, they just do such a great job of both being vulnerable, like modeling that, and also like reciprocating it. And so I really appreciate you bringing this conversation to math, because while we may instinctively know that this creates really healthy relationships and communities in life, I think having this conversation allows us to be really intentional to create or like facilitate these conversations, both in like PLCs, but also in the classroom as well. And so thinking about the importance, because we always hear like, you know, as a teacher, like you should model it or you should ask these beginning of the year questions, but you're really getting at the why these are really powerful and why it is really important for us to go first and to show our students that we make mistakes, to show our students that we have things that we are lacking confidence in and things like that. So I really appreciate that, that angle to this. It's not one that I feel like I've directly heard talked about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the fun part about going outside the math world is you get ideas that are really applicable to what we do, but it's just not, it's not in the literature that we're mostly encountering in the work that we do.
Yeah. So you've talked a lot about professional development and, well, not necessarily professional development, but just like professional relationships. And obviously that plays a part in professional development. We may encounter resistance in professional learning. And so I believe you and your team have a lot of really exciting things coming up this year around professional learning. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell us about it. Cause I want to know, I've seen some things on social media and I'm like, okay, I want to know what's going on.
Okay. Well, first, like the biggest thing we're most excited about is that so I've been in the work in the world of like online learning for a long time, like way back in 2012, when I was first hired at Mount Holyoke College, I was challenged to try to like take this program and really make it accessible to people outside of just Massachusetts. And I started working with a startup company at the time called Zoom that you might have heard, right? It's they were brand new.
The Zoom.
They were a startup company, and it was really wonky. Skype was like the thing at the time.
Yeah.
And Zoom was like just trying to get in fact, I think people from Skype like went off and like started like Zoom on their own. But it didn't have breakout rooms. There was like very little, it wasn't very user friendly at the time. But I had this idea of like, could you create this classroom experience for people online that felt like they were right in the class? So I kind of brought my video production background in and set up the classroom spaces like a TV studio, and we were using Zoom. And we've been thinking a lot about how do people want to learn? How do people best learn? And we've interviewed people, we've looked at research, we've kind of found the key elements of really high quality professional learning for educators. And we designed a set of 8 courses, all focused on building teachers' content and pedagogical knowledge, which gets at that resistant piece, but we're doing it in this new learning format that we've designed called intersynchronous learning, which people are still like, what is it like? It's one of those things it's so massive. So I don't want to take this whole time, but I'll describe sort of the core elements of it, which is, we know what asynchronous learning is. We know what synchronous learning is, and they feel almost like opposites, right? It's just this, there's just like, it's one or the other, or maybe hybrid, which is some, and there's a million different definitions of hybrid. What we are thinking about when we think about intersynchronous learning is it is the intersection of all of the different learning modalities that work, that adult educators are looking for, that any learner is really looking for, and the intersection of all the different ways that you could learn. So we've developed these courses that could be done completely on your own, but you feel like you are with a cohort. You actually have a cohort. We have a video production studio. So we have teachers that are part of your group that you're, though on video, we're breaking the fourth wall. We're, you're fully engaging with these people, even though it's on a video, you're doing math and getting your thinking pushed by this group. But you could also have the same course experience with a whole group of colleagues. And so we've almost layered this so that if you want to do this with your whole staff, if you want to do it with a partner, if you want to do it on your own, that the experience is the maximum engagement that you could possibly have. And we couldn't be more excited because we've been testing it in lots of districts, and the feedback we're getting, people like, this didn't even feel like I was online. It felt like I felt like these were my colleagues. And right. And the other piece is people were writing about like the impact it's having on their classroom. Like, I've shifted the way I'm teaching. Some of the questions we asked is like, I used to think and now I think. And so we'd have people saying like, I used to think I had to be the one telling the kids everything, and now I see how important it is to facilitate the learning of students. And these are people who were self-paced. Like, so they went through on their own. And so for us, that was what we were trying to do, is take what we know to be all the great elements of in-person professional learning and to replicate it in each of these different formats so that everybody can get the most out of it. And so this, we could not be happier about this coming out. So that's the big one for us. And then the other thing that people can look forward to from us is that with our production studio, we are creating lessons, tasks, resources, all for free for teachers. So we have resources on our website at flinteducation.com for preschool through high school teachers. And they're all like really engaging. We've got great routines. And we also work with a lot of colleagues who are in the field who are working with us to develop lots of these things that we can share. And we're just going to keep adding to that library. So if people are looking for really good tasks, good thinking tasks, good opening routines and stuff, we have you covered. And we're also open to suggestions. So people are welcome to reach out and say, hey, could you create something like this? Or we would love to do something like this.
That's awesome. I cannot wait to see it. I'm so excited for y'all and just the work that you are doing for teachers. And I appreciate you spending time talking to me. I know you said Flynn Education, the website, is a great place for teachers to go. If they want to get in touch with you, is that the best place as well? Or Instagram as well?
Hit me up on all the socials. Like, we're on everything. And we have, the company's got like one, but you also just look me up. And it's I'm mostly Mike Flynn 55, because there's a million Mike Flynns out there. and so Mike Flynn 55 on most of the socials is where you'll find me. Website and stuff is fine. Or just mike@flinteducation.com if you want to just shoot me an email. That's always great too.
Yeah. So you may not have like a super unique name, but you've got a super unique approach to online professional learning. So
yeah, exactly.
Cannot wait to see that. But thank you so, so much for just being so generous with your time and your knowledge. I know teachers are going to really enjoy this conversation. So thank you so much for chatting with me today.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation.